Welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Robert Tindall about his book, The Shamanic Odyssey, Homer, Tolkien, and the Visionary Experience. We're having a very interesting conversation here about the Western civilization, the culture, the heritage storytelling, going back to the Odyssey and weaving in Tolkien and a lot of other things. Very interesting conversation. I want to carry on to talk more about some of the material from the Odyssey. We're talking about the Cyclops, of course, before. There are a lot of other components to the story, but one of them that struck me that I was reading about in your book is of course, the Circe, the interesting kind of experience that Odysseus has with Circe. Tell us about this, how you interpret this.
Well, the first really blazingly evident clue that there is something shamanic going on in their relationship, and this is generally recognized in the scholarship, was the way that Odysseus has to seek out an apotropaic plant, to block Circe's spell. Because what's happened is Odysseus's men going up to visit this palace, which is on top of the hill, surrounded by tame and fawning predatory animals, such as wolves and lions, which spook the heck out of Odysseus's men. They find a goddess within a chamber weaving and singing an enthralling song. So, this group of Odysseus's men go inside, except for one crew member who stays outside, who's suspicious of what's happening. And they get seated, and Circe serves them a very interesting drink, which transforms them into swine. Now, animal transformation, as my book discusses, is the second oldest game in the world, if fertility is the first. Because in the Paleolithic sacred sites, not only have these Venus figurines been found that we're probably familiar with, carved of mammoth bone, that have the giant pendulous breasts and the huge generous vulvas, right? Everyone interprets those as goddesses of fertility. Same time period, we are finding figurines of half man, half animal. The most famous being a lion man, has a lion's head and a human body. And we know that there are certain plants that will create this experience for people. They're from the Solanaceae family, known in Europe as mandrake and in the New World as Jimson weed, Datura. These are plants that have been known for many, many thousands of years and are held as sacred. And were used in initiations. We have early colonial accounts of such initiations, for example. And so animal transformation is an old game. The way that Circe transforms them into animals and the whole setting she's in pretty strongly suggests that she's a potentiatheron, a mistress of animals, a similar figure to the one that Burckhardt detected in the Cyclops. She holds and releases the animals. And what she's done here is she's taken the souls of Odysseus's men as a virtual offering and encarcelled them within a human body with an animal head. That's actually the way it's depicted in some of the ancient Greek vases that we've found. And so Odysseus has to go up and face this circumstance, and he has no idea what he's going to do. And so as he takes his sword, and as he's climbing up to her palace, no doubt he's praying his ass off. And on the way, he encounters Hermes. And Hermes has appeared to him in the guise of a young shepherd, just sporting his first beard. And Hermes approaches Odysseus and teases him a little bit because he knows everything that's going on and says, boy, you know, you're doomed. They says, wait, I know a plant that can help you. And that's where we meet the moly. Now, here we've got it, right? There's the sacred plant, the spirit of the plant. It's appearing as Hermes, yes, but if you know how in the Amazon, shamans will have dreams of a particular plant which can heal a certain malady or remove a curse, and wake up and then go out and find it, or can even send their apprentices out there to find it by describing a way. It's clear that in indigenous cultures, the spirit that manifests is simultaneously the spirit of the plant as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so what Hermes does is, as is typical in these kinds of episodes, these oneiric experiences of the permeability of consciousness, is he gives instructions that are very specific to Odysseus about how to handle Circe, and then plucks the plant himself, because Odysseus says that it's dangerous for mortal men to pull from the ground. Odysseus takes the plant, goes into Circe's palace. She attempts to drug him, and it doesn't work, thus revealing the arrival of Odysseus, who Circe has been expecting, because Hermes had already told her that one day Odysseus was going to come and her plants were not going to work on him. So Circe is pretty excited about this, and they end up being inducted into a year-long feast, basically, that really seems to have a very deep imprint of the opium experience. And this seems to be the other lineage that's running through this story. Now, I should first say that Circe restores Odysseus's men, and when they're restored, they're taller than ever, more handsome, younger, and in better health than they ever were before.
Right.
So it was obviously a pretty beneficial experience for them. And then Circe diagnoses Odysseus and his crew and says, you guys are worn out. You know, you're a seer. You've been worn to the bone in your travels. And basically, we see that kind of dawning of the Otherworld Feast happening here, where you're inducted into a sense of timeless eternity. And they get their rest. In fact, it's so pleasant. They're there for a year before Odysseus's men finally rouse him and say, look, you know, we got to get on to home. Now, here we have the Potnia Theron, the mistress of animals, who also passed over to Aphrodite, too.
Mm-hmm.
Burkert says that she's very strong in the Paleolithic, and then her characteristics break up and are taken up by Artemis. Here we see her in Circe, also in Aphrodite. But we also need to remember that there's a memory of Crete, that marvelous island civilization that appears to have been primarily matriarchal and operated with this open sense of beauty without enclosed fortresses, very little cult of war. And, you know, from excavations on the islands, they have found opium sanctuaries.
Yeah.
Where we see an opium goddess whose hands are raised in trance, and she's wearing a crown of opium poppies that have been slit for the sap.
Hmm.
And they've found ashes upon the floor that indicate that they were burning the plant within there, and so people were entering into the orbit of the opium pure land, if you will, within that experience. And, you know, opium has a terrible reputation now, you know, because of the products of that it's been manufactured into. You know, when Bayer made it into heroin, everyone thought it was a good thing. But what you lose when you manufacture drugs is that sense of plant sentience, of the communion with an intelligence, a consciousness which is greater than your own and is outside your own. And opium was considered a great gift in the ancient world, truly a great gift. If you consider how much pain was a daily feature of their lives and what a blessing opium could bring, it's not hard to understand why. Now, in rings that have been found, including in the ancient Greek Mycenaean world, which is the culture of Odysseus, we see her being worshipped. She's seated beneath a tree. She has that Minoan double axe, right? So, you know, we know where she's coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And that her, Circe's ability to engulf people within this timeless orbit, as well as her amazing skill as a pharmakeus. Phagos, I think, translates it as witch, but it doesn't do her much justice. we also get that, you know, there's more than one lineage that's going into her appearance in the Odyssey. And I should point out too that if you kind of, you know, cite individual examples, it can sound more speculative than it really is, because the Odyssey is filled with consciousness-altering plants. I think the first time we really get a hit of it is when Telemachus, Odysseus' son, goes and visits Menelaus. And, of course, you know, Menelaus and Helen are a little tense after all these years, right? Helen chooses to mix some special concoction into the wine that evening in order to lighten things up.
Mm-hmm.
And the effect is so powerful that Homer says that even if Menelaus and Telemachus and the other people there had seen their own children being slain in front of them, they would have laughed and found it delightful.
Oops. All right.
This is major stuff. This is, I think it's Dale Pendel who comments that opium goes well with tropanes. So there's a really cunning mixture that is being utilized here. And women are known for that in the Odyssey. There are also the lotus eaters that Odysseus runs into and his men, and they've got this lotus that when Odysseus's men eat it, it's kind of like the effect of heroin on shell-shocked Vietnam vets. You know, it's all the pain disappears. You don't want to do anything else but just reside there, and Odysseus actually drives them back to the ship and lashes them to their benches by the oars. And they're weeping and crying. They don't want to go. We see this kind of power manifested in plants, but we also see it coming forth in the songs of sirens and in the bards.
And this, this you tie back to the because you do have a section on the Celtic significance and the singing as well, the tradition of the songs, right?
Rapturous song, sure. Yeah, that's experienced in many cultures. There's a marvelous story in the mythological cycle of the Irish Celts about Lugh visiting the palace of King Nuada, where he plays on his harp, and first he makes everybody laugh their heads off, and then he makes them all cry their hearts out, and then he puts them all to sleep. Bob Boyle, I was telling Bob this story, and he said, gee, that's a lot like my Huichol, mentor, you know, his teacher of peyote shamanism and the Huichol tradition down in Mexico, used to do, because his songs and ceremonies had different modes. And one of them was the mode of the orphan, where you cried your heart out, and then came the mode of the blossoming, where it seemed like the whole world opened up and a deep sense of like rejuvenation and hope and happiness and beauty came to you. And of course, then you have the Icaros that are sung down here in the rainforest too. So, and there are many ancient records of songs among other cultures as well.
So what do you make of the similarities? Is it just a trait of how the different cultures developed and again, these different sacraments were part of it, and hence there just is rising a similarity between them, or is it more deeper than that? What do you think?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. It seems that for people, if there's a plant to be found, they're going to locate it.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and, you know, ethnobotanists in the Amazon have commented on the fact that like the statistical probability of ayahuasca being the brew ayahuasca, which is a combination of the vine ayahuasca and here in Peru, an additive plant, which is equally sacred called chacruna. She's the one who paints the visions. And, you know, chemically, when you analyze her, it's the DMT that is combining with the MAO inhibitors and other chemicals, molecules that are in the male ayahuasca that creates the potent effects of the plant brew. And the chances of them arriving at this particular mixture by trial and error is sort of astronomically remote. And if we take indigenous people for their word, when you become intimate with your ecosystem as a living system that is conscious in its own way and that you can interact with by virtue of permeability of consciousness, it's not that surprising that people located these plants and ways of using them.
Yeah, I've said it before, but I mentioned it for those who haven't heard about this story. We did an interview with Jeremy Narbis, who wrote The Cosmic Serpent, and he relayed this story, basically, that it was also through another plant or substance called Datura, where they basically came in communication with, you know, the spirit, the essence that told them to how to make the brew, pretty much. Pretty incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, these are culture bringers.
Define that a little bit more. How do you mean culture bringers?
They teach the skills that humanity need in the old ways.
So that is something that basically is... How should we put that? Is that something that is encoded within the creation, I guess we can call it that, itself? That we have assistance along the way and get lessons and taught things? What do you make of it?
Well, one revelation that I had at the end of my first journey into the rainforest that I record in The Jaguar That Roams the Mind is in the Garden of Eden, we weren't listening to some voice outside of the garden named Yahweh. It was the garden itself that was speaking to us.
Yeah.
And it hit me as an astonishing metaphysical reversal. you know, I grew up with a lot of Christian influence and I still have a very profound respect and veneration for the Christian way. There's this very deeply ingrained idea, though, that has become fixed in our heads that we're separate from creation.
Yeah, it's strange to me. And then in European history, we go on these kind of weird tangents as well, where we at a certain point then even go on these witch hunts and everything else, right? The Dark Ages, the plagues, and eradication of various things, and we're basically so far removed from nature and sacraments as one can be at that stage. And it's also from after that point, I guess, that much of mankind is, it's kind of, I don't know how to put it, maybe broken down to be rebuilt by another intention, shall we say. It's like we lost the bond completely there at that point. I don't know. What do you think?
I think Europe's just had a really hard time of it. You know, the Crusades brought a lot of vitality back into medieval Europe, even though it was a very aggressive war that we conducted for 200 years down there. But the Arabs were way far ahead of us at that point and injected a lot of good things back into our culture. But also, you know, the so-called discoveries of America, you know, that was another huge influx of vitality and life into what had become a pretty used up landscape. You know, we were a backwater when Cortez was looking down at Teotihuacan. You know, he was seeing a more beautiful, better developed city than anything existing in Europe at the time. It was a marvel.
I've seen some interesting parallels, if you will, that there seems to have been some, well, maybe not borrowing, but some architectural ideas for certain things. There's actually even a parallel between the, what is that stretch called again? Is it Teotihuacan with the Pyramid of the Sun and the Moon? In any regard, it's actually an architectural similarity to how the later Vatican and the surrounding buildings are actually laid out. And I always wondered, wonder if there's some borrowing going on there. But anyway. So why don't we talk a little bit more about, I want to return to Tolkien again. You have one chapter in there where you call J.R.R. Tolkien and the intensified trajectory of consciousness. Tell us about this, Robert.
Okay. Well, the intensified trajectory of consciousness is a theory developed by the cognitive archaeologist Lewis Williams. And there's an incredibly elegant book called The Mind in the Cave that I recommend to everyone. And it's a kind of, it's the best like rough sketch model for entering into visionary states that I've found. It's a little clumsy, but it's very useful. And essentially what Lewis Williams is saying is that our ordinary spectrum of consciousness is where we go from daily, awake problem-solving orientation to the far end of complete unconsciousness and sleep. But when we alter our consciousness, either with a psychoactive substance or through some other means, rather than entering into the hypnagogia that leads us into a deep dream and then sleep, we start encountering entoptic phenomena, which probably many of your listeners are familiar with. Those mandalas and dancing images and geometrical will-o'-the-wisps that begin drawing you into that experience of the other side, the waking dream. And then Lewis Williams hypothesizes a stage of construal, where the mind kind of grapples with, like, okay, what am I looking at? Where am I going? What's the significance of this? And once the kind of focus is found and you pass through that that portal, if you will, the passageway into deeper trance, then you enter into the stage that Lewis Williams unfortunately calls hallucinations. And I don't really like that classification because it suggests that the visions that come in these intensified trajectories of consciousness are mistaken or are epiphenomenon of consciousness. And the data just doesn't hold up to that. That may be true for schizophrenics, but certainly that's not true for trained shamans who can go into these states of consciousness and come back with perfectly empirical, functional information and activity in the daylight world, and who function at a very high level of integration and ability. So I just prefer to use visionary for that stage of the intensified trajectory. And what I do is I take a look at J.R.R. Tolkien's final unjustly neglected little novella that he wrote when he was quite old. It's called Smith of Wootton Major. And, you know, Tolkien was just struggling to get the Silmarillion together as he was aging. And there were so many branches to it and so much still to discover that he just wasn't able to impose order on it. But it was his great ambition to get it published before he died. And Tolkien spent quite an amount of time not only writing this final novella for us, but he also left a lot of very fascinating speculative notes about the human relationship with fairy or the other world as a kind of theoretical underpinning for the story. So this stuff is fascinating to look at. It's fascinating. It's his last literary will and testament. And in it, the story is quite simple. On the surface, we have a boy named Smith who ends up in a celebration, which happens every decade in his little town, where he swallows a fae star. And that star comes from fairy, and it's cooked into the cake. It's baked into the cake. And a deserving, you know, however you conceive that, boy or girl will end up eating that fae star every generation. And so when Smith gets older, one morning he wakes up, and a marvelous thing happens. He hears the song of nature. And it's so beautiful, he bursts into song, just like receiving an ikaro. And he sings as surely as the elves sing in the other world. And then, popping out of his mouth, comes the fae star, and it lands in his hand, and then he claps it to his forehead and plants it there. And when he starts making journeys into the other world, he ends up being called Starbrow by the people there. And as you see him making these journeys, we see him going through, and you know, in the long run, the stages of mastering this trajectory of consciousness, because that's really what you also see in the Odyssey, is these are mature people who are not frightened by the spiritual realm, or they have a healthy terror of it, let me put it that way, and are willing to go in to reckon with the profoundest issues of fate, of life and death, by entering into the other world. And we see that happening when Odysseus goes down to Hades to consult with Tiresias. And we also see it in the episode where Menelaus ambushes Proteus in order to get from him the reason why he's not able to sail home and he and his men are starving, trapped on a particular island. We can kind of bookmark that if you want to come back to the Menelaus episode.
Sure, sure.
Okay. So what we see with Smith is his moving into that terrain, and he starts by looking at one flower, you know, for like 4 or 5 hours, which probably some of us have experienced. And then he moves more and more deeply in, and he starts entering into terrains where he sees things that at first he can't even quite remember, which probably a lot of us are familiar with too, because the intensified trajectory is very rapid. But gradually he starts developing the capacity to remember, and he begins bringing back gifts and skills from the other world. And For instance, he becomes so skillful a metalsmith that he could make weapons that would be the subject of song for generations, but he chooses not to. Finally, Starbrow penetrates to the very heart of the other world, where he encounters the queen. And she gives him a revelation where Starbrow understands that this ridiculous little doll of a fairy queen that he had seen on top of that cake that he'd eaten the Fae Star from was a manifestation of her in the waking realm. And Starbrow feels such shame for the way that, that humanity is so blind to divinity that we could do that. And yet the queen comforts him and says, better that than no memory at all. It's heartbreakingly nostalgic. And then the queen lays her hand on his forehead, and Starbrow has a vision of being both in this world and outside of it, and he understands things from an even larger perspective where he has great sorrow and great pain from seeing things from the perspective of his queen. And then, of course, he sleeps, you know, and he wakes up having gone through life review. And understands how everything fits together. And when he goes back, he's required to surrender the Fae Star to pass on to the next generation.
Hmm. As I'm listening to this as well, I wanted to ask you about what you think Tolkien then is tapping into, shall we say. He has this interesting part of the Red Book of her guest, I think, or the Red Book of Westmarch, right? They're kind of connected, this Welsh history and poetry that contains manuscripts and such, that he has tapped into something. I mean, he was studying language. He understands clues and keys within the language, and somewhat around this, he develops a mythology. Some people have speculated that it's actually a somewhat of a true story that he's retelling, in at least in the Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit and Silmarillion and all those. But what do you think when you're kind of involved in his work, what is he tapping into? Did he use sacraments himself, do you think, to realize some of these things?
No, I don't think he did at all. And I could be wrong, but I don't think he did at all. Tolkien was a genuine Catholic. And of course, you know, Brother David Steindl Rast, who's also one of the most genuine Catholics I've ever met, you know, has recently written that, you know, there's no, if you can see God in other ways, there's no reason you can't encounter him in a mushroom. Either. This is not to exclude the possibility, but I don't think so. You know, I mean, this is a guy who survived the trenches in World War I and made it through World War II, you know, in the time of deprivation there. And I mean, he's in the heart of World War II composing The Lord of the Rings. And I just, like, Schultes hadn't published anything yet. I mean, there was no general knowledge of these plants at the time, and you know, the idea that they were getting over to Merton College in Oxford seems kind of remote to me.
Mm-hmm.
And also, they don't grow there. You know, it's not like you can go out and pick a psilocybin mushroom out of cow dung in Suffolk or something like that. Mm-hmm. So, I don't think he needed it. You know, Tolkien used to have this wonderful thing he'd say when there'd be something about his understanding, his depiction of Middle Earth that he didn't know, and he'd say, I'll have to go and find out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there was something visionary occurring here with Tolkien, for sure. And his express goal was to recreate the pre-Christian mythology of the European people.
Yeah.
And as I understand it, The Hobbit came about when Tolkien was looking at one of the lists that you find in the Elder Edda. And in that list, there were these names of all these dwarves, you know, Balin and Dwalin and Thorin and, you know, et cetera.
Sure.
Like, all the dwarves that show up in The Hobbit. And right in the middle of that list is the name Gandalf. But Gandalf means magician elf. So So what the heck is a magician elf doing in the midst of a list of dwarves? Tolkien asks himself. And this begins his process to mythopoeically recapture the ancient stories that the surviving manuscripts of the Middle Ages simply capture the slightest remnants of.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me if it's if there's more to the story then, and how do we view? I mean, if we again look back in mythology of mankind, we see that there are all kinds of creatures, there are all kinds of interesting events taking place that we you know, today seemingly never would encounter. It's like a different age, basically. Is this an explanation of the spirit world of the things that are alive around us, or is it more literal than that? Is it something that actually was experienced at the time, prehistory? What do you think?
Well, I think, again, you know, when we go back to those concepts of fluidity and permeability, it's pretty helpful, you know. So instead of asking, is this literally true or not, we can ask ourselves, well, under what conditions could such experience arise?
Yep, right.
You know? You know, the variation's incredible in human experience. And, you know, Shakespeare says there's more between heaven and earth than is dreamt of in our philosophy.
Yeah.
So I like to walk a middle path between a belief, literal belief, and sort of outright rejection with works. If we understand that this is a human inheritance which signifies something really important for us, we can find the right kind of approaches to them, you know. And then, you know, I think then we cherish our own spiritual experiences, you know.
Certainly.
You know, and these inform us, you know, they inform our ability to interpret and commune with our ancestors and understand these documents and understand the origins of our culture. But again, you know, these spiritual truths that we find, they're not for broadcasting. You know, this is our own mythopoeic imagination weaving us.
Mm.
And it's not ours. It's bigger than us. So there's kind of method and a kind of responsible, intelligent approach to this material we've been fortunate to inherit, and also what our indigenous elders have to teach us still.
So, don't mean to cut you off, but I do want to get into this section as well. What you see about reigniting this, understanding, first of all, we can say, and then maybe later on, there could be an experience, or maybe there's the experience first, and then understanding. I mean, again, different approach will be different for anybody. But what about the even the idea now then that Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit, etc., has been kind of again launched into mass consciousness with the new films? Is that aiding anything? Is it sending any messages on a deeper level, do you think?
Well, it's really hard for me to tell because I grew up on texts. You know, I mean, I was reading The Lord of the Rings when I was it was the Reagan era, and things were pretty dire back then. And, you know, Tolkien was medicine for me because I had grown up on the streets. You know, I was left in a children's shelter when I was 9, and I'd gotten the short end of the stick. And I was pretty bitter. I felt that society was essentially a lie was marching off in its mechanistic way towards an apocalypse, and I was pretty doggone upset. And looking around me, too, in that time, it seemed like all the mature males running the show were corrupt.
Yeah.
And Tolkien was the one that showed me through his characters like Aragorn and Gandalf and Faramir, Fangorn, the kind of essential nobility that a human being could possess, where they were at service, they wielded their power for the service of blessing and aiding others. And they knew who they were servants of, and that was a greater order to which they belonged.
It's a true nobility, not some kind of stupid bloodline thing, kind of.
Yeah, it wasn't a stupid bloodline, nor was it, you know, I seized power through tricking the Electoral College and, you know, buying off the Supreme Court.
Yeah,
you know,
that's another league altogether. But yeah, I got
yes,
you.
Exactly. Just no corruption at all here. And that was really medicine for me. It was very, very good to hear. You know, so Tolkien actually struck me as far more true in the sense that real allegory should be, even though Tolkien said there's no direct allegory in my work. In the sense of real allegory, it struck me as being far more true to the actual life here on Earth than anything that I was seeing in my society at the time.
Yeah.
And I was very disappointed with the films. Because I saw a systematic degradation of the masculine wisdom of the patriarchy. And I don't mean patriarchy in the oppressive sense, but, you know, the guys who are holding it together, our job, in the films. So the character of Faramir was degraded, Treebeard terribly degraded, Gandalf as well. And when I was done watching, who's the Theoden, the king of the Rohirrim as well? I mean, when I was done watching the films, I was like, did they have an agenda here to Elrond? All these characters were given base motives, displayed cowardice, made self-centered decisions, and I really cannot understand the rationale for changing Tolkien so profoundly in the film.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of the mythological potential, the teaching potential, was lost in Jackson's films. I don't think the medicine is there.
Really? From my point of view, there's still so much that is coming through from Tolkien's work that it even a less talented filmmaker would still do a pretty good job at turning out something that would be, watchable, I guess. The continuation as well, by the way, I got to say, the Hobbit, watched it a few days ago. It's fantastic. I love it.
Yeah, The Hobbit was fun. I watched it last night, and I think he did a much better job of The Hobbit. My point, though, is this. It was long ago recognized by Walter Benjamin that film was a form of wholesale liquidation of our cultural inheritance.
Mm-hmm.
There's a marvelous essay of his, The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, that everyone should read. And in the taking of texts, which I think we should call Tolkien's work sacred at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Why not?
Mm-hmm.
They're sacred texts. When you take them and you so fundamentally alter the meaning of them, have you not liquidated the text? You can't rewrite Shakespeare. You can mess with him a little bit here and there. I mean, you can move things around, but you can't have Hamlet saying things different than what he says.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
the light is getting to know Shakespeare through the enactment of the works even more profoundly. So why don't we respect Tolkien in the same kind of way? Why don't we try to get to his heart? And the films, I don't know, maybe, but for me, it wasn't happening in them.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And I'm concerned, really concerned, that the films are going to get, you know, not only in the way now of people's understanding of Tolkien, but they may actually derail the literary inheritance of Tolkien within our culture. So I'm hoping they're forgotten
within
a few years.
Well, that's an interesting take on it. I hope as well that it is the reawakening of it, and also that more people go to the source of the work themselves and continue, I guess, the journey from there. But Maybe that's wishful thinking. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that you need to find the text first.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't want people's entryway into the Lord of the Rings to be these films. No, no.
Okay. So what about the other aspects of reigniting as part of your kind of your book is about, of discovering the visionary experience again, you know, coming to that in our age, in our time right now? Yeah. What can be done, do you think?
Nothing much. You know, it's going to happen or not. You know, I think it's, you know, the best thing is to let the drive come through, you know, not to get in its way. I know that when I first drank ayahuasca, it pretty much saved my life. And my gratitude to Juan Flores and the other healers that worked with me and to the plant, and as well now to the Native American Church, which has also saved my life. The Peyote Way is profound, very profound. I should add as well that I've done about 20 years of training as a Zen Buddhist. So I didn't come into these traditions without kind of grounding already in a spiritual discipline.
I see.
It's very helpful to have, because it's easy to get overwhelmed by the visions. There's a way that there's a kind of gratitude and a veneration that comes out of having access to this kind of blessing that I think needs to guide us.
I usually ask people, and when we talk about these subjects, do you think that substances of any kind, I mean, there's so many different out there, I think they will be different, that works you know, well versus not so well for different people, but do you think it's something for everyone? Is there always something beneficial in it for everyone?
Well, you know, of course it's for everyone. I mean, you drink a cup of coffee, you alter your state of consciousness.
Absolutely, of course. You know? Yeah,
sure. Like you eat a carrot, you alter your state of consciousness.
There's nothing you can't do that won't alter it. You know, anything you do will alter it, right? You can't step outside of that.
Go breathe some air. See what happens. But in terms of, you know, so that's just to say we're all experiencing the same thing here, you know, but in terms of, like, is everyone destined to drink ayahuasca, I sincerely doubt it. I think that there are, David Mignogni talked with Bob Boyle about some very interesting things from the Hopi perspective. One of them is the reemergence of soul tribes or soul groups, and basically, what Mignogni said is that people are going to start finding their way back to their tribes now, and that people tend to reincarnate in this world kind of like a landing flock of birds or something.
Yeah.
Where we come in groups, in tribes that we belong to. And, you know, just as a metaphor, I'm not saying that any of this is literally true, because I don't know, but as a metaphor, it's very beautiful, because you know, so much of the lack of vitality and the sadness and the crime and just all the terrible things that are happening in our world today that are so sad and so misguided, like, come from people not knowing who they are and where they belong and having a true community and family.
Mm.
You know? Mm. And I see the emergence of this sense of tribal belonging as being incredibly valuable. It's really taking yourself out of the main frame of the matrix.
Let me ask you this. Yeah, I think that would be interesting. What do you make then as a kind of opposition to that, of this whole global emerging governmental system that we're seeing around us?
Pure bullshit. Can I say that on the radio?
Of course you can. You can use harder words than that.
Oh God, it's a catastrophic crime against humanity.
Good. Yeah.
It's just if man, I mean, in the Huichol land right now, sacred land, Viracuta. They've been making pilgrimages here for thousands of years. These are old, old, old people. They've been around a long time. They're about to strip mine that sacred place. A Japanese multinational corporation is aiming to strip mine their sacred grounds. Only these multinational trade agreements could allow for such an abomination to occur. We need to go local and just say no to this level of manipulation of world resources and people's right to their individual autonomy, their cultural traditions.
I see them being eroded all over the place at this stage, unfortunately.
We're under siege. I mean, where I'm going tomorrow into my Antioquia to be with Juan Flores, the oil companies have been you hear the helicopters pounding over the land, and I've actually lain in a hammock listening to oil exploration equipment beeping out there. And in Peru, you only own the first foot of layer of the land. Beneath it, it's in oil companies. 95% of Peru is now available to exploitation by any oil company that wishes to buy it up.
Hmm.
There's no place to hide. So it's really a struggle for survival. It's a global struggle for survival of native indigenous people.
Not so positive for the future of mankind, in other words.
Well, I know this insane infrastructure has to come down. It can't keep being sustained. But, I have a 3.5-year-old daughter that I love beyond all things.
Yeah. Let me tie it back to the Hopi Prophecy Stone again, because in there you detailed with the two paths, basically, and you have a little story in the book about this not being... Well, things that are not central to what the purpose is, the things that are not on solid ground, so to speak, they're not meant to be. We're in a time right now where these are going to begin to crumble as well. I mean, to a certain extent, I think we're witnessing this around us, the problematic kind of development of this global structure that we've been talking about. There's a lot of issues there right now.
Yeah, it's not taking care of humanity. It's as the Hopi say, it's pursuing individual gain and spiritual disunity. And the figures on the stone break up, like the arms and heads and feet drift off the body, and they dissolve.
And maybe that's the way they have to be then. Do you think that we have to walk their path, if you will, or should there be a more active resistance, quote unquote, against it? What do you think?
Well, I think the active resistance is engaging in prayer and forming community and, taking up the ways that follow the leader of the earth, to follow the Hopi model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To return to our senses. I mean that in the true sense of the word.
Sure. All the other senses, too, because there's a lot of forgotten ones, if you will, or neglected ones.
Exactly.
All right. Well, again, then I want to give out, we're coming to the end for the second hour here in a little bit, but I want to give out the titles again, Robert, here. The Shamanic Odyssey, Homer, Tolkien, and the Visionary Experience. I've really enjoyed the conversation. I thought it was really interesting. I love talking about some of the aspects of Western culture, the European indigenous people and what they have as well, because most often it is neglected and forgotten as well, and there is a tradition and a heritage there that is very, very beneficial to us as Europeans. So I think that's very interesting and very, very good to know about. And again, the website is roamingthemind.com. That's where you can go to find out more about the book, but also then about Robert Tindall and his wife, co-author Susan Bustos, as well. Anything else you want to talk just in the last minute or so, Robert, about the floor is yours? Anything you want to leave us with here before we end?
Well, I want to say thank you so much. It's really been an honor and pleasure to talk with you. I don't know if I have a lot to add. I feel fully expressed now.
Any encouragements, I guess, for our audience if they feel a little bit down from your last few minutes here?
It was Martin Luther King when he was leading one of the marches through Alabama where they were being shot at by snipers and attacked by police dogs, where he was asked, like, you know, aren't you appalled by the circumstance? And King smiled and said, no, we're just getting it all out in the open here. I'm really deeply hopeful about and deeply committed to the future of humankind, you know, having an extremely special child, you know, which all children are, really opens your eyes to that absolute necessity. We got to take care of the children. Got to take care of them. It's just there's no option here. And I really do believe that the an awakening of the native mind and the forming of community that is based in an intimacy with the earth, a symbiosis with the earth, is essential for us. And it doesn't exclude other ways of knowing, but it should be primary. That's the conclusion that I've come to after my years of training in these indigenous traditions.
All right. Well, very good. We'll end on that note then, Robert. Again, thank you for sharing that with us and spending some of your time with us today. I wish you have a great rest of your day down in Peru and enjoy it, of course.
Thank you. Thank you for the honor of being on your show.
I always want to extend my thanks to you for listening, for being part of this, and of course for just being interested and engaging in topics that are trying to decipher the strange journey of mankind, reveal the corruption, and shine a light on forgotten, neglected, and hidden aspects of our history. We'll be back in just a few days. In the meantime, I hope you have a great rest of your day, evening, or night, and we'll talk more soon.